Good morning, BFUU.
Good morning.
Hi, it's great to be here. So I want to start, you know, when we're in the streets, there's often a chant that goes, whose streets? And you probably know the answer to that.
Our
streets, right. But here in Berkeley, I know that you're also aware that we're on somebody's land. And whose land are we on? Ohlone land. So I want to just acknowledge the people who've been here since time immemorial. And thank you for inviting me to speak with you today. I want to think with you about waking and rising. And BFUU seems to be the perfect place to have this conversation. You have a reputation for being one of the most woke congregations, possibly in the country. And I've been to many political events here over the 35 years that I've lived in the Bay Area. And one of the things that's coming up here is that you've agreed to host the upcoming PPC Faith Outreach Training that Tom and Virginia have been working on. And so we really appreciate that. And I know that some of you also joined Virginia during the 40 Days of Action in 2018. So I want to thank you all for all you do to bring justice to an unjust world. So it's commonly said among folks on the left, stay woke. And woke is good. Not everybody is. What do you think are some of the things that keep us from waking? I didn't hear you.
Money?
Obfuscation? What's it? Well, I didn't hear you.
Habit.
Mm-hmm.
Lies.
Diversions.
Fear.
Greed.
Greed.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes, those are some of the things that keeps me from waking. Ignorance, miseducation, overwhelm. Some people just are overwhelmed. And once we're woke, what do you think keeps us from rising?
Busyness.
Busy. Other thoughts?
Fear.
Yes, absolutely. Despair. And some people have a belief in rugged individualism. They think pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And then there are the distractions, like shopping and gambling and television and pornography and addiction, right? So those are some of the things that I think keep us from rising. So as I was preparing for this talk, I thought a lot about my mother, Velma Myhand. She was woke. Well, half woke. Because and I remember about the UFW called for a boycott from 1965 to 1970. My family never stopped eating grapes. And, you know, I just reflect on that because it would seem that as a black family, we would be in solidarity with brown people, you know, on the principle of many, many fronts, one struggle. But it wasn't true in my family. And the reason that I say she was half woke is because when she was pregnant with me, Emmett Till was murdered in 1955, which, by the way, it took until last week for the U.S. to finally decide that lynching was a federal hate crime. And, you know, so that's some indication about where we are and what time it is. But everybody has their own journey. And so I believe that she was woke to the conditions that we faced as black people, but she didn't see rising together as a strategy that she could embrace. Living in a small town in Northeast Ohio, there was no movement that sprung up there. No people assembling in public square, no signs, chants, or demands. In fact, she told me that the only marching I would be doing was down the street and to the schoolhouse. And she worked tirelessly in the schools my brother and I attended to make sure that we got the best education offered in the public schools we attended. And I have gratitude for her love and support. It helped me develop skills and confidence that have served me well. But it didn't fundamentally change or even challenge the system that she was preparing me to survive. It took many years for me to find my way to political action. As a young adult, I found feminism, which formed the base of my political development. After college, I began working in what we now call the nonprofit industrial complex. I spent a decade doing violence prevention work, challenging racism, sexism, homophobia, anti-Semitism, and other forms of oppression. I was woke. But when I came to what I have come to understand about those early years of my activism is that the work was weighted towards social service, but not social change. An important development in my political life, one that moved me from woke to rising, was when I got connected with the Global Women's Strike and women of color in the Global Women's Strike, an international organization based in London that houses the Wages for Housework campaign, the Payday Men's Network, the English Collective of Prostitutes, and other movements for justice. Coordinated by Selma James, widow of C.L.R. James, she has been fighting for economic and social justice for more than six decades, and she has not given up. It was there that I met grassroots women from Haiti, Peru, Guyana, South Africa, who shared the perspective that the caring work we were all doing should be valued, and we should be paid so as not have to live in poverty. That's a good, especially during International Women's Month, it's important to value the work that women are doing. So I want to, you know, just give that shout out. 2020 actually marks the 25th anniversary of the UN's Fourth World Conference on Women, which was held in Beijing. There, the Global Women's Strike pressed their demand that the value of unpaid caring work done disproportionately by women be counted and a dollar amount be assigned. We estimate that caring work is worth nearly $11 trillion. And since 73% of the population living in poverty are women and children, recognition of the contributions that women make gives power to the demands for a fair share of the budget and inclusion in decision making. The strike calls on governments around the world to invest in caring, not killing. In January 2006, I was part of an international delegation that attended the World Social Forum held in Caracas, Venezuela, where Hugo Chavez, may he rest in power, had won the presidency in 1999. It was my first experience of being in a country where state power was actually being used in service of those who had the least. And for people who've been to Cuba, that may have been an experience where you had got to recognize that actually state power could be used in service of the poor. And there in Venezuela, we visited health clinics in neighborhoods that were staffed by Cuban doctors. We talked to university professors who explained that education was free, but that once educated, you were expected to use that knowledge in service of the people. We met women who were organizing the government-run food delivery system that was reducing hunger among the poor. Here was the evidence. It could be done. A country could decide to prioritize the needs of the people, and the people were prepared to defend their revolution. Woke and rising to this day. When the Poor People's Campaign formed in 2018, it was a natural fit that the strike would become a partner. I've been organizing with the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, since 2019, just before the national Emergency Truth and Poverty bus tour came through. The tour highlighted the true emergencies afflicting the nation's 140 million poor and low-income people. There were 28 stops, including Oakland, where there was a hearing to amplify the stories of people directly impacted by poverty, systemic racism, militarism, the military economy, and environmental devastation. I was invited to tell my story. I was made homeless by Chase Bank. They foreclosed on the home I lived in with my partner after we became unable to make the payments. They refused to modify the mortgage, even though they had taken a $25 billion bailout from the U.S. government, promising to use the money to keep homeowners in their homes. for 3 years with the support of Occupy, Global Women's Strike, Casa Justa, Just Cause, and others in our community, we demonstrated outside the bank, organized phone zaps, interrupted the auction at the courthouse, and fought to keep our home. Eventually, a judge ruled against us in an unlawful detainer lawsuit, giving the sheriff the go-ahead to evict us. Even though we didn't win that one, I learned valuable lessons about the power of people coming together to demand justice. What drew me to the PPC? The principles, the demands, and the way they show up to fight alongside people in struggle. Like the fight at Oak Flat, Arizona, where Apache Elder Winsler Noisy Sr. and his community are protecting the sacred land from extraction. Oak Flat is under threat of destruction by Resolution Copper, which was given the rights to mine. And that means that they would be using 6.5 billion gallons of water annually, which usually a small city uses that much water. It's just outrageous that they would be using the natural resource that way. And then the water would be polluted with sulfuric acid. These operations would replace the holy ground with a gaping crater 2 miles wide and 1,000 feet deep. We got to hear from Winsler's daughter, Vanessa, at the Poor People's Campaign Moral Action Congress that Virginia mentioned earlier, held in June of 2019. The Poor People's Campaign is also taking action in solidarity with the Graduate Student Association at UC Santa Cruz, who went on a wildcat strike in December. They're demanding a cost of living increase to address the gap between what they earn and what it costs to be housed in Santa Cruz. And in doing so, the GSA acknowledged that significant numbers of students there are unhoused and hungry. Students on the UC Santa Barbara and the UC San Diego campuses joined the fight on Friday, and the administration responded by notifying 54 students that we know of their intention to fire them from their spring quarter teaching appointments. Outrageous. So in a statement of support, the Poor People's Campaign denounces the threats that are being used against graduate students who are demanding a decent standard of living at UC Santa Cruz. Confronting the decision to pay rent or buy food, the graduate students at UC Santa Cruz decided in December to stand up for their basic needs and demand a modest cost of living allowance of $1,412 per month. The median monthly cost of an apartment in Santa Cruz is over $1,600, and it is one of the least affordable places to live in the country. Meanwhile, the striking students currently earn less than $2,500 per month. And Reverend Dr. William Barber, national co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, stated, "President Napolitano has chosen to respond to this crisis of poverty with a repressive position that promotes structural violence against the poor. We stand with the UC Santa Cruz students and teachers, lifting up their demands for a cost of living increase and against the immoral choice between going hungry and being homeless." This weekend, the Poor People's Campaign is in Alabama for the More Tour stop. We must do more, mobilizing, organizing, registering, and educating people for a movement that votes. We know that regardless of who is in office at any given time, it's the movement that actually holds them accountable. The 28-stop tour is shining a light on the conditions of those impacted by systemic racism, poverty, ecological devastation, the militarism in the war economy, and the distorted moral narrative of religious nationalism. On Friday, they were in Mobile. Yesterday and today, they're in Selma, and tomorrow they'll be in Birmingham. I'm sure many of you remember what happened on February 28, 1965, which has come to be known as Bloody Sunday. It's the 55th anniversary of poor people in Alabama crossing the Edmund Pettus Bridge and we're commemorating the violent response of the state, honoring the woke and rising folks who dare demand recognition as full citizens. Congressperson John Lewis was beaten that day, survived, and went on to win a congressional seat. And as you may know, he's battling pancreatic cancer. And so I would ask that we hold him in our thoughts and prayers. Locally, we've been supporting Moms for Housing in their bold strike against corporate greed, supporting curbside communities facing eviction, assisting with the construction of tiny homes for youth and adults, and food delivery to unhoused people, while we press state and local governments to create real solutions to the problem faced by their constituents who are poor. Using the Poor People's Campaign moral budget as a template, we demand that police budgets be cut and the wealthy and corporations pay their fair share of taxes, and that they fight poverty, not the poor. We're gearing up to take 50 people directly impacted by poverty to the Mass Poor People's Assembly and Moral March on Washington, D.C. The event will amplify the voices of poor people from more than 40 states across the country. And we invite you to organize a BFUU delegation and hit the streets with us on June 20, 2020. I also want to let you know that on March 16th and 17th, Reverend Barber and Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove will be speaking in Oakland about the mobilization for June. Thank you for your time, attention, and generous support of our efforts to bring people directly impacted by poverty to D.C.